Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Today is Saturday, August 14th. We're talking about back-to-school season and the new hurdles students and parents are facing this year. For starters, many kids are re-entering the new school year at a severe disadvantage. A recent study by the consulting firm McKinsey & Company found kids didn't learn as much as they normally do last year when the pandemic kept taking them out of their routines. Elementary school kids across the country are now about 4 to 5 months behind where they should be. We're speaking with the lead author of the study, Emma Dorn, about how parents and teachers can help their kids catch up and what's at stake for everyone. But first, we'll hear from Dr. Kate Williamson of the American Academy of Pediatrics. She'll weigh in on what schools and parents can do to keep kids healthy, both physically and mentally, as they enter another school year under threat from COVID-19. Welcome, welcome to the Newsworthy's Special Edition Saturday, when we sit down with a different expert or celebrity every Saturday to talk about something in the news. Don't forget to tune in every Monday through Friday for our regular episodes, where we provide all the day's news in 10 minutes. Fast, fair, fun, and on the go. I'm Lacey Evans, filling in for Erica Mandy during her maternity leave. It's now time for today's Special Edition Saturday. Dr. Kate Williamson, thanks for joining us on The Newsworthy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Last school year, most kids had to deal with at least some virtual learning. But this year, there's a big push to get as many kids as possible back into the classroom. So what's changed between now and then?
The biggest thing that's changed is we know how hard it is for kids to stay at home and stay virtual. The other thing is we know how to decrease the spread of the virus. So with both of those things together, I feel confident to say, let's get our kids back in the classroom and let's do it safely.
What does safely mean? What is your advice about masks?
I definitely recommend that kids wear masks in schools. Over the course of last year, there was actually a lot of in-person learning. Not everybody was virtual. And for the kids who went to school and for the schools that were open, we learned a lot about how to reduce the spread of the virus. And it's so important that a number of things are done. And one of the most crucial things is mask wearing. So mask wearing, in addition to hand washing, keeping kids socially distanced, making sure that kids with coughs or fevers don't come into the school, all of those things are together really reduced and sometimes eliminated the ability for the virus to spread from kid to kid within the schools last year. That was even during some of the heights of the pandemic in the wintertime. And so all of those things, including mask wearing, is absolutely essential this fall, especially with a virus or a variant of the virus that is more contagious. The more kids who go unmasked makes that risk much higher for all the kids.
What is the latest data about how COVID-19 impacts young people and how likely is it that they'll be infected?
Fortunately, kids tend to get less serious illness or at least less likely to get a serious illness when they do get COVID. But low risk doesn't mean no risk. And unfortunately, I've seen just here in Orange County and at our local hospital, lots of kids get really, really sick. And sometimes it doesn't matter if you don't have any risk factors. It doesn't matter that you're little, you can still get really sick. That's the scary part, right? You just don't know which kid is going to get really, really sick. As far as the spread of the virus, kids can get sick just as much as the adults can. So the virus, particularly with the Delta variant, it's highly contagious. It is very, very likely to spread. And as I've told a lot of my patients' parents, something I'm very nervous about is the likelihood that their children and my patients will be exposed to the virus the next few months is really, really high.
Do young children need to avoid grandparents, let's say, or maybe other adults with weaker immune systems once they're back in school, once they're back in these big group settings?
So there's no blanket answer for that, unfortunately. I really think that each of these cases needs to be taken case by case. First and foremost, are the adults that the kids are going to be around vaccinated? Because if a grandparent is vaccinated, the likelihood that they will get the virus and then get really sick from the virus is much, much lower. And so that's the first thing. The second thing is whether or not that child, of course, is vaccinated. If it's a child who's 12 and older who's vaccinated, that's extra protection for that grandparent. And if it's a child who has only been around vaccinated persons or kids at school who are fully masked, that also reduces the risk. So once you start adding all these things up, I think it's totally safe for that child to see their grandparent. But if any of those aren't, you might need to rethink that.
What other precautions can parents take at home to keep their young children safe, especially those ones under 12 who don't have a vaccine available to them yet?
The best way to protect your children for anybody who's under the age of 12 is to make sure that everybody around them who can be vaccinated is vaccinated. And if you do have a child who's 12 or older, the best way to protect them is to get them vaccinated. Everybody deserves to get those antibodies in their body when they can to keep them safe, because the virus is going around and we want to keep our community as safe as possible.
Let's talk about mental health. How can we help kids navigate all these changes and what is still really a scary circumstance?
I have unfortunately seen so many of my patients struggle from a mental health perspective since the beginning of the pandemic. I think first and foremost, what was so difficult for them is going from a lifestyle of being very social and being in school, being around friends and family, and then going into lockdown. That's not just for kids, right? All of us were definitely impacted by that, but even more so for kids because they're meant to be social, they're meant to be around others. The amount of depression and anxiety, eating disorders, and then obesity because kids weren't moving around as much was just truly astronomical. That has improved as things have opened up a little bit more and kids are starting to go back to school. But we also still have this fear of the what if, right? What if my friend gets sick? What if I get sick? So I think that next thing is to talk with them about those risks and what that really means. I never recommend to sugarcoat anything for kids. I think even at all ages, you need to have a degree of sharing with them, you know, kind of what's going on that's age appropriate, and talk to them about, well, that's why we wear masks and that's why we wash our hands. And that's why we waited to see grandpa until, you know, we got our vaccines or grandpa got his vaccine. So I think all of those things can make the child or adolescent feel more comfortable knowing that, hey, I've done everything I can to keep myself, my family, my friends all safe. I'm going to go ahead and start living a more normal life. If you have any questions, whether it's about masking, whether it's about getting your child vaccinated, or just about the virus itself, I always recommend for parents to talk with their pediatrician. We have been here taking care of your kids and working hard to make sure kids are healthy and safe for a very long time. And since the pandemic, we're still there doing our best to keep the community safe. So please reach out to us as a resource. Your pediatrician wants to hear from you and definitely wants to help.
Still ahead, the pandemic severely delayed learning during the last school year. We're talking to education expert Emma Dorn about which students were most affected and what can be done to help them make up the lost ground. But first, here's your main host, Erica Mandy, with today's sponsors.
Ritual's prenatal vitamin is definitely part of my morning ritual, and I feel great about taking them every day because their multivitamins are formulated with high-quality nutrients in bioavailable forms that the body can actually use. In fact, I first heard about Ritual vitamins from my doctor, and the more I looked into them, the more I became a fan. And now I've been taking them for more than a year. They never upset my stomach, whether I take them with or without food, and they don't have a gross taste either. Depending on which one I'm taking at the time, they're either minty or citrusy. I've taken the regular women's multivitamin as well as the prenatal and now the postnatal, but I recommend them for all women, men, and teens. Plus, with Ritual, I never worry about running out. Ritual multivitamins are delivered every month with free shipping always, and you can start, snooze, or cancel your subscription anytime. So get key nutrients with Ritual. And right now, Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Just visit ritual.com/newsworthy to start your ritual today. That's ritual.com/newsworthy. This episode is also made possible thanks to our next sponsor. Whenever I'm having a hard time making a decision between two choices, I try to always stop and ask myself if there is a third option, a different solution or middle ground that maybe I hadn't thought about before. Well, the same can be true when it comes to health and fitness. There can be a lot of pressure to label certain foods just good or bad, or to follow some strict rules if you want results. Well, Noom feels that just creates unnecessary dilemmas and stress. Instead, Noom wants to change how you see food with a psychology-based approach to building healthier habits. It's not about making you feel guilty or regretful. Noom's cognitive behavioral approach is about better understanding your relationship with food and then empowering you to make healthy choices that work with your lifestyle and can be long-lasting. You get to choose your health goals, and Noom will then personalize a program for you. And Noom only needs a daily 10-minute check-in. So start building better habits for healthier, long-term results. Sign up for your trial at Noom.com/newsworthy. Again, you can sign up for your trial at Noom, that's spelled Noom.com/newsworthy.
Thanks, Erica. Now to my conversation with Emma Dorn. Emma Dorn, thanks for joining us on The Newsworthy.
I'm very glad to be here.
First, briefly explain for our listeners how your firm conducted the study on elementary school kids.
Sure. So we partnered with Curriculum Associates, which is a formative assessment provider, and they run the iReady assessment for about 1.6 million kids across 40 states. And those were the kids who took the assessment in school this year. And so we wanted to really make sure that the assessment environment was the same when we were comparing to kids who had taken the assessment in previous years. And so what we did is we looked at kids who had taken assessments this spring, and we compared their results to kids who had taken assessments in previous years, in 2017, 18, and 19, and compared to see whether kids were ahead or behind due to the pandemic.
And you found that they were behind.
We did indeed. So on average, students were about 5 months behind in math, where we would expect them to be, and about 4 months behind in reading. And this is a fairly significant amount when you think about a school year being a 10-month school year, more or less. That's what we used in our calculations. And so that's really half a year behind in mathematics.
How did a student's family's income level or minority status influence the results?
This is one of the things that really worried me about our results, is the effects were not equitable. We couldn't look at the student level income. You can't ask a kindergartner what their income is, but we could look at school level demographics to get a sense. And what we found is that students in majority Black and Hispanic schools have really suffered disproportionately. Students in majority Black schools were about 6 months behind in math, and students in low-income schools were 7 months behind.
Would you recommend repeating a grade?
This is a really difficult decision that I think is for each parent. My sense is that for most students, the best approach is actually kind of an interim approach. It's not repeating all of the content you've done before, and it's not jumping straight onto content that you can't access. There's been some really interesting research that shows that providing students access to grade level standards, but also actually scaffolding them so that they can access that content effectively. So instead of going through all of the content of third grade, for example, is you can hit the fourth grade content that you need and then work out what pieces of third grade are necessary to actually access that and succeed.
So what kind of long-term impact could this unfinished learning have?
So I think it could be significant. You can see already the unfinished learning, but also some of the mental health costs on students affecting engagement with school. We see increasing number of students being chronically absent, and that often leads to high school dropouts. And as you know, if you drop out of high school, you're just less likely to get a job that can really fulfill you and also help you support a family. And so we looked at what does that mean on long-term earnings for students. And what we estimate is that students are going to see about $49,000 to $61,000 less in income over their lifetime due to the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, this really has a domino effect for the whole economy. It's not just an individual setback, right?
Yeah, because if you have fewer students graduating high school, fewer going on to college, then it hurts the productivity of the whole economy. And so as these students enter the workforce, it's going to have an impact on GDP. We actually estimate that income could be as much as $128 billion to $188 billion per year from 2040. And that's annually, that's going to hit the economy.
How can we close this opportunity gap? What sort of changes do you think we need to see in our education system?
We have to not only take into account the unfinished academic learning that students have, but also all of the other impacts of the pandemic, the mental health impact, the social and emotional impact. And so as states and districts are looking to support students, I think doing those two things in parallel is really important. And given that, I think there's a couple of priorities. The first is to really re-engage students into effective learning environments. A bunch of kids have either dropped out entirely or have just been disengaged with learning over the last year. And then the second is to help them recover. And there's a couple of programs that can be really effective. On the academic side, high dosage tutoring. They found that if you provide a student tutoring, now high dosage sounds like a little bit of a jargony word. So let me explain what that is to you a little bit. It's tutoring that is 3 to 5 times a week, 30 to 50 minutes each time, really integrated into the school day. And students who've had access to that kind of tutoring have been able to learn 1 to 2 years of additional math, for example, in a single year.
You mentioned mental health briefly, so I want to talk about that a little more. I mean, how impacted were children by the pandemic, and how is this affecting them in school?
This is one of the most sobering pieces, both personally as a parent, but also as a researcher. We did a survey of 16,000 parents across all 50 states. 35% of parents were very or extremely worried about their students' mental health. That's over a third of parents very or extremely worried, and actually over 80% had some level of worry. So we also asked parents, well, what exactly are you worried about? And what we found is that there was a real increase in parents who were reporting that their students were suffering from anxiety or depression, or exhibiting really worrying behaviors like social withdrawal, self-isolation, or lethargy. And I even see with this, my own kids, the desire to kind of go up and shoot hoops with me and the desire to do a really great job on a project. There's just a, what's the point? And so I think it's really important for districts to be thinking about that as well as academics as we re-enter the school year.
Is there anything parents can do to help kids who might be struggling right now?
I'm a parent myself, and I ask this question all the time. I think one thing is just to listen to your kids, to hear where they are, to understand this has been a really tough year. High expectations are always important for kids, but not unrealistic ones. And so being able to partner with your kids to not expect this to be fixed in a minute. As we think about actually the federal response, this $200 billion that's been put towards supporting students to recover is over 3 years. And I think as parents too, we need to be looking over the long term and thinking not just about the academic recovery, but also about supporting our students to re-engage with school, with friends, and with society.
Thank you to Emma Dorn and Dr. Kate Williamson. For details about Emma's study and more advice from the American Academy of Pediatrics, check out the links in our show notes. That's it for today. Your main host, Erica Mandy, will be back from maternity leave on Monday for your next news roundup. Until then, have a great weekend.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.